Welcome, everyone, to the first session of the Mormon History Association Conference 2019. And we get to start out the day with a fantastic panel highlighting Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's landmark book, A House Full of Females, Plural Marriage and Women's Rights in Early Mormonism, 1835 to 1870. Laurel is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and recently retired professor from Harvard University, and she was past president of the American Historical Association, as well as recent past president of the Mormon History Association. She and her husband, Gail, recently moved from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and now live in a big stone house near Philadelphia, and Laurel stays very busy with her nearby children and grandchildren, consulting at several Philadelphia museums, and with learning to navigate a new city. And to briefly describe Laurel's book to give you some context as we begin, as the title suggests, she emphasizes the world of women and their roles as plural wives and activists. She takes the reader through well-trodden territory of Kirtland, Nauvoo, and frontier Utah, but she also tells the stories of saints in places that are typically overlooked, especially in histories of this nature, such as New England, the British Mission, Iowa, Winter Quarters, India, and San Bernardino, California. She represents the voices of people using only contemporary sources, so sources written at the time that the events occurred, and she does not tend to rely on life writings written 40 or 50 years later. In doing so, she gives us a fresh perspective and innovative look at this time period and interrupts the traditional narrative a little bit that way. And even though this book emphasizes women's relationships and activism, men also play an important role in the book, and she weaves together men's and women's voices in an important and seamless way. And on a personal note, I was a research librarian specializing in women's history at the Church History Library for 10 years before switching gears and choosing to stay home with my young son. And I was lucky enough to work with Laurel as she visited the library to research. So I know firsthand how carefully and seriously she studied all the many different documents to try and pull many different story threads and weave them throughout her book to tell a very individual story to represent the full multifaceted Mormon experience during this time period, and I think she's done that masterfully. So our panelists to comment on the book today are Gary Bergera, Claudia Bushman, and Christine Talbot. Gary James Bergera is the managing director of the Smith Pettit Foundation and the company director of Signature Books, both of Salt Lake City. He is author, co-author, or editor, co-editor of 7 books. Most recently, he edited the diaries of Leonard J. Arrington, published in 3 volumes as Confessions of a Mormon Historian. And there will be a panel discussing his work in session 5H tomorrow, if you want to make note of that. His publications have received awards from the Mormon History Association, the Utah Historical Society, and the Dialogue Foundation. And he currently serves on the editorial boards of Journal of Mormon History and the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal. He is the 2018 recipient of the Leonard J. Arrington Lifetime Achievement Award from MHA. Claudia Bushman, an American historian, has taught at many universities, most recently Columbia University and Claremont Graduate University. She has written 15 books about 19th century America, many about Mormons and women. Her Mormon books include Mormon Sisters, Women in Early Utah, Contemporary Mormonism, Latter-day Saints in Modern America, and Mormon Women Have Their Say. She was the founding editor of Exponent 2 in 1974 and the New York Mother of the Year in 2002. She and Richard Bushman wrote The Building of the Kingdom of God in America and reared 6 children together. And Claudia and Laurel have known each other for over 50 years, beginning as Boston revolutionaries who helped initiate the second wave of Mormon feminism through their work on Exponent 2 and beyond. And in a sense, I feel like House Full of Females is sort of a nod to their past as well. And then Christine Talbot is Associate Professor and Coordinator of Gender Studies at the University of Northern Colorado, where she has served for 10 years. After receiving a graduate certificate in women's studies, She received her doctorate, a PhD in history, emphasizing U.S. women's and gender history, both from the University of Michigan. She teaches courses in feminist history, feminist and queer theories, intersectionality, and introduction to gender studies. Her book, A Foreign Kingdom, Mormons and Polygamy in American Political Culture, 1852 to 1890, was published in 2013 and examined the national controversy over the Mormon practice of plural marriage. So each of these critics will present their remarks, and then Laurel will respond to them, and then we will open the session up to questions.
My focus this morning is on Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's treatment of plural marriage in Nauvoo, Illinois, in her important and immensely readable work, A House Full of Females. For the past nearly three decades, I have studied, off and on, the emergence of plurality in Nauvoo. It is a topic that continues to hold my interest. That said, I begin with a caveat. There are many, many times when it seems to me that the more I research the beginnings of Mormon plural marriage, the less I know. Thus, my comments regarding Ulrich's work are informed by my continuing efforts to make sense of what I may never fully understand to my own satisfaction. Ulrich treats the topic of plural marriage in Nauvoo in portions of three chapters. Three, I Now Turn the Key to You. Four, A Favor for Which I Have Long Desired. And five, Many Females Was Received into the Holy Order. Ulrich's analysis of plural marriage is not systematic, but a part of a panoply of teachings, events, and personalities upon which she builds her reconstruction of Mormon life on the banks of the Mississippi. When she introduces the topic, which she terms not as polygamy or plural marriage, but to her credit as celestial marriage, she calls on the experience of Eliza R. Snow. On June 29, 1842, Snow began to keep a diary, which also happened to be the day when she was sealed in celestial marriage to Joseph Smith. As an aside, I have become cautious to suspicious about accepting without corroboration the memory-dependent accounts of Nauvoo's polygamists, but I agree that Snow's plural marriage most probably occurred on the date she began her diary. Ulrich then explains, quote, there were so many secrets in Nauvoo in 1842 and so many rumors, contradictions, and denials that it is impossible to know precisely what happened and when. There is no question, however, that Joseph began experimenting with what people later came to understand as celestial marriage and that these new relationships were creating ripples, not just among Joseph's close associates, but in councils of church leaders and meetings of the Female Relief Society, end quote. Thus, Ulrich seems not so much interested in attempting a history of the development of plural marriage in Nauvoo as an account of participants' and others' interactions with what she, Ulrich, describes as plurality's, quote, dimly glimpsed and still inchoate implications, end quote, as well as, quote, contradictory promises, end quote. Thus, as Ulrich insists, quote, to understand the emergence of plural marriage in Nauvoo, we must attend to what these women and others like them cared about, end quote. Ulrich next broaches plural marriage in some detail when she writes, quote, some biographers assume that Joseph invented the doctrine of plural marriage in order to justify illicit relations with vulnerable young women. There is some evidence to support that assumption, but the early Nauvoo sealings do not fit this profile, end quote. While sexual attraction may have been a factor in Smith's doctrine, Ulrich continues, other drives were as, if not more, powerful. For example, four of the first five women Smith reportedly married early in Nauvoo ranged in age from early 20 to late 40. Three were already married civilly, one was recently widowed. The one thing these women had in common, Ulrich says, is not vulnerability, but, quote, intense religiosity, end quote. No doubt, but I can't help suspecting that for Smith, the women he married shared other traits as well. Later, Ulrich speculates that at least one, perhaps more, of Smith's plural wives, quote, was in love with an ideal as much as with a person, end quote. I wonder if Ulrich would apply the same observation to Joseph Smith. A few pages later, Ulrich returns to Eliza Snow's plural marriage to Smith and offers an especially enlightening analysis of the real-world questions that Smith's teaching must have elicited for participants, both male and female. Quote, "It is hard to imagine what Eliza's marriage actually meant," Ulrich writes, setting the noun marriage off in quote marks. Quote, "None of the traditional criteria applied. The ceremony was performed by Brigham Young and witnessed by Eliza's friend and landlord, Sarah Cleveland. But there was no public acknowledgement of the news, of the vows, no cohabitation, and apparently no promise of material support. No one knows whether Joseph Smith's relationship with Eliza involved sex," end quote. I'm certain that the same or very similar things could be said for the men agreeing to enter such relationships. How were they to acknowledge their new wives? What was their responsibility towards them? What were they expected to father children? If so, how soon? And what was their responsibility for their plural children? I don't believe that we today can emphasize too strongly just how confusing life in celestial marriage, especially during the Nauvoo period, was for the participants. Not surprisingly, as Smith began to expand the circle of celestial marriage initiates, rumors of licentiousness began to circulate. Ulrich writes, "The astonishing thing about these records is not that people were gossiping about the sex lives of important men, or that some women and men took advantage of salacious rumors to justify their own behavior, but that in the midst of public turmoil, Smith continued to expand the practice of plural marriage," end quote. Some writers have suggested that all of these marriages were spiritual for eternity only. Ulrich, however, seems unpersuaded. Quote, "If that was so, why the obsession with secrecy?" End quote. It is also possible to look at cognitive dissonance reduction theory to speculate that an increase in plural marriages in the face of the increasing possibility of exposure and condemnation may have functioned, in fact, to justify in the minds of advocates the divinity of the principle. New plural marriages did apparently stop briefly for a period immediately following the John C. Bennett episode in the spring of 1842. Ulrich is correct, I believe, not to dismiss entirely Bennett's allegations. She also points out insightfully, quote, that at some point Smith and his allies decided that trying to differentiate Smith's teachings on plural marriage from Bennett's iniquity, the term Smith and others used to describe Bennett's own sexual activities, was not worth the risk. Outright denials that anything unusual was happening in Nauvoo seemed safer and also more likely to restore public sympathy and internal cohesion. In the short run, that strategy worked, end quote. Smith himself told the Nauvoo City Council in early 1844, quote, "When a man becomes a traitor to his friend or country who is innocent, treacherous to innocent blood, I do consider it right to cut off his influence so that he could not injure the innocent," end quote. Beginning in chapter 4, Ulrich turns to the experiences of others involved in Smith's new doctrine and provides useful examples of the dangers of relying solely on the later accounts of participants. This is particularly true when the later memoirs try to convey their writers' initial shock, repugnance, and disapproval at the idea of Smith's doctrine. Ulrich points out, for example, that Eliza Snow merely referred to events of, quote, "particular interest," end quote, to her feelings on the day of her marriage to Smith in 1842, and not to any sense of, quote, "very repugnance," end quote, as she later recorded in 1877. Ulrich also notes that Valette Kimball, married to early polygamist Heber C. Kimball, years later reported experiencing in 1842 a vision of, quote, "the principle of celestial marriage illustrated in all its beauty and glory," quote, end quote, after having struggled to accept it, yet also stated a short while later that she really did not know, quote, "much about the strange practice she had embraced," end quote. Ulrich concludes that, quote, "plural marriage did not drop out of the heavens fully formed, nor was there a single path to acceptance. Repugnance was there, but also curiosity and ambition to be part of an elite inner circle. For some women, plural marriage offered spiritual and economic security. For a few, it was a way of defying convention, and for others, a religiously sanctioned way of leaving a troubled marriage," end quote. And for some men, Ulrich adds, quote, "plurality was an answer to their troubling sexual feelings," end quote. At this point, in A House Full of Females, and for the next 10 plus pages, Ulrich turns to the extraordinary example of William Clayton, who, she reminds readers, produced, quote, the only detailed contemporary account of plural relationships in Nauvoo, end quote. As Ulrich is only one of a handful of researchers outside the LDS Church History Department to have been granted access to the originals of Clayton's Nauvoo diaries, her use of them is especially illuminating. For me, Ulrich's use of Clayton is a masterclass in how to read and interpret a historical source. I won't attempt a summary of Ulrich's discussion, but if you have the book, pages 86 to 98 alone are more than worth the book's retail price. Here is but one example of Ulrich's insights on parsing Emma Smith's opposition to plural marriage. From page 92, Ulrich writes, quote, some historians assume she, Emma, was primarily opposed to Joseph's involvement with other women. William Clayton's account suggests that she was also concerned about the well-being of her family. If Joseph's disdain for community norms once again led to his arrest, or worse, she would be left alone and penniless with four children to raise, end quote. See also on page 93, Ulrich's comments on Eliza Snow's reducing herself, quote, to a state of infancy, end quote, which permitted her to deny, quote, any moral responsibility for Emma's distress over plurality, end quote. Chapter 5 introduces Ulrich's discussion of the Nauvoo Holy Order, later called the Quorum of the Anointed, composed of church members who had received their temple-related endowments and who, at a minimum, had been instructed in Smith's celestial marriage doctrine. Ulrich also broaches in some detail the second anointing ritual, which fortified a sealed couple's claim on each on one another and also bestowed upon them special blessings and rewards. As events continued to develop in Nauvoo, it became increasingly difficult to keep such developments, celestial marriage, endowment ceremonies, promises of godhood, secret. Of all of Smith's innovations, Ulrich notes that, quote, plural marriage created the most lasting damage within, end quote. In fact, quote, the more Joseph insisted on his innocence, the less credible he seemed to those who heard of his still secret revelation or who knew of his puzzling assignations, that is, his meetings with his wives, end quote. Through the remainder of the chapter, Ulrich relies upon the voices of the women and men devoted to Smith to narrate events leading to and following Smith's death by mob on June 27, 1844. These women and men include Wilfred Woodruff, Phoebe Woodruff, Mary Ann Young, Valette Kimball, Bathsheba Smith, William Clayton, Lenora Taylor, and Joseph Smith's plural wife, Zinah Diantha Huntington Jacob Smith. In fact, Ulrich devotes several pages to the question of Zinah's marriage to Smith now that Smith was dead. Married eternally to Smith, presumably with the consent of or at least acquiescence of her civil husband, Henry, Zinah and presumably Henry had to decide if she would remain Henry's earthly wife or agree to marry Brigham Young. Ultimately, Zinah chose Brigham. Ulrich's earlier observations about plurality's inchoate implications and contradictory promises seems especially apropos. In conclusion, I would like to offer a final, possibly misguided or off-base comment regarding what seems to me to be an interesting rhetorical analytical device that Ulrich occasionally employs. For especially controversial events, she sometimes cites the work of other historians without offering her own conclusions, opting instead to let readers arrive at their own decisions about the historical truth of the events. For example, on page 89, Ulrich writes that, quote, most biographers believe Emma Smith vacillated in her support for plural marriage, sometimes acquiescing to Joseph's sealings, sometimes resisting. Even if she had agreed to some sort of bond with the Partridge sisters, Emma and Eliza, she was understandably disturbed by the incident of Joseph meeting privately in a closed room in their house with 21-year-old Eliza Partridge. She did not want her children to see their father meeting with a maidservant behind locked doors, end quote. When I read this, I didn't think twice at first that Ulrich accepts the story of Joseph and Eliza Partridge meeting privately. However, while I still think Ulrich probably accepts the historicity, I'm not 100% confident that she does. I think what Ulrich wants in dealing with these kinds of especially contested events is for the reader to confront the same kinds of issues that Emma probably did. Their factual historicity may not be as important as creating an empathetic or psychological connection. As I read her, Ulrich relies both on the tangible detritus of history in their various manifestations and on the emotional psychological investment of her readers. Ulrich's treatment of plural marriage in Nauvoo is not necessarily groundbreaking in the sense of uncovering new documents, etc., though her use of the Clayton Diaries comes close. Nor do I think Ulrich wants to be groundbreaking in this particular sense. Her project, as I read her, may be something else. In addition to Ulrich's overarching agenda, Mormon and the question of women's rights, I think Ulrich acts as both historian and archaeologist and wants to resurrect for readers today a foreign country populated by now exotic peoples of seemingly strange beliefs and especially practices, and in doing so, hopes that her readers come to appreciate that these mysterious creatures are, in fact, us. Thank you.
Nineteenth century Mormon women, particularly polygamous women, distant in the Salt Lake Valley, occupied a significant place in the American imagination, playing on the Oriental stereotypes in the of the age, with Brigham Young as an Eastern potentate, the Mormon women were imagined as pampered beauties. Visitors with this view were disillusioned, as was Mark Twain, who memorably dismissed them as a pitiful and homely lot. Evidence for this preoccupation is a lecture by a Protestant minister promoted in an 1870 Boston newspaper. William B. Wright had traveled from Boston to San Francisco on the Transcontinental Railroad to exchange pulpits with a fellow minister, spending months in California. Back in Boston, after a brief stopover in Salt Lake, he announced a lecture. Not the declining buffalo, not booming California, but Mormon women, their views of their family life, their personal appearance, their attempts at fashion, their jealousy, their faith. Those poor Mormon women, neither voluptuaries nor hags, but ordinary, plain country women, were frequently misrepresented, glamorized, sentimentalized, or denigrated. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, the celebrated historian of early America, recovers their reality. As the title of her book suggests, women were sometimes the majority of the household. The women, though often submissive in their marriage, formed cooperative family female communities, shaped their own lives, and voted 50 years before other American women. Yeah. Ulrich, as she has done elsewhere in her excellent books, matter-of-factly deals with the lives of the Mormons, male and female. There were many styles of polygamy, as Gary has pointed out. Joseph Smith married 30 or so women in addition to his wife, Emma, but he did not live with, acknowledge, support, or have known children with his other wives. Brigham Young practiced a more domestic polygamy with his more than 50 wives and more than 50 children. He acknowledged and supported them, living openly with them. Mormons denied that lust was an incentive for plural marriage. As Ulrich says, Mormons both glorified reproduction and urged sexual restraint. Divorce, however, was readily available and not infrequent. Ulrich coolly and meticulously lays out the evidence of doubt, devotion, eagerness, affection, secrecy, and powerful attraction in plural unions. She uses contemporary writings to tell her story. Two lengthy documents anchor her narrative: the minutes of the original 1842 Female Relief Society, which show women interacting in spirited ways, and the minutes of 1870 planning sessions for a series of so-called indignation meetings in which women defended Mormonism and plural marriage in thoughtful speeches against national governmental interference. These two documents preserve the potent public words of these women. The Female Relief Society, which emerged during Mormons' tempestuous days in Nauvoo in 1842, originally conceived of a charitable agency to aid temple construction workers. It was privately run and financed by women. Eliza R. Snow, the articulate and literate secretary, kept and preserved the minutes, showing the earnest involvement of the women, guaranteeing the society's significance into the future. The society closed down in 44, but was resuscitated in Salt Lake City in 54. Brigham Young's vision for the Relief Society was practical, to care for the poor and to avoid the purchase of expensive items which had to be imported into Utah. Meanwhile, Eliza R. Snow's vision included reaffirming the religious authority of women. The indignation document preceded a published account of the proceedings of the 1870 meetings against the Cullum Bill, a federal effort to punish the practice of plural women. Women spoke publicly against the bill, which would have confiscated Mormon property and required wives to testify against their husbands. The mass indignation meetings held throughout Utah territory in 58 towns and attended by about 25,000 Mormon women were a publicity coup. Women, mostly Anglo-Saxon and born in the United States, defended the marriage of multiple women to a single man and the right to choose their own husbands. In 1869, the previews of the Mormon, previous to the Mormon-dominated legislature, the previous year, the Mormon-dominated legislature had granted women the vote, the second U.S. territory to do so, after Wyoming, allowing Mormon women to be women's rights campaigners as well as hags in harems. The Cullum Bill did not pass the Senate. The 29 speakers at the Salt Lake City indignation meeting were articulate, mature women, seasoned Mormons who had suffered various persecutions in the East and made sacrifices to settle in the West. They accepted polygyny as a theological concept. They had close sororal relationships with sister wives and other women in the Relief Society groups. They wanted to be left alone. Another category, major character category of sources for Ulrich's narrative is the Mormon diaries like that of Wilford Woodruff, who joined the church in Connecticut in 1833. Ulrich, who puts interesting facts together, notes that he married his first wife, Phoebe, in 1837, and that in 1853, Phoebe, then 46, married 16 years, bore her ninth and last child. Woodruff had by then married seven women and fathered 10 children, although only three wives and four children remained with him. He then married three young women and fathered 23 more children. Ulrich reports that some Mormons preached that nature intended men to sire children well into their maturity, while women, having reached menopause, were put aside, and they had reached the limits of their usefulness, thus increasing the number of children per father and decreasing the number per mother. And it's interesting that Woodruff, who became president of the church at the age of 82, issued in 1890 the manifesto which discontinued polygamy, act, as he said, for the temporal salvation of the church. So he saw the whole thing. Ulrich uses many other diaries, notably those of Patty Sessions, a frontier midwife, Hosea Stout, an articulate policeman, the effusive William Clayton, and Mary Richards, a spunky textile worker. In using these sources, Ulrich is able to access people's daily, personal, individual lives. They act in real time rather than in recollection. Through their eyes, we see the women bless and heal each other and speak in tongues. We endure the miseries of persecution and the trek west. We see families grow and disintegrate through marriage, birth, and death, through the addition and subtraction of wives, through disaffection, harmony, and happiness, through jealousy and infighting. We gain a close look at the centrality of women in the spiritual, mystical, secretive practices of early Mormonism. Ulrich's narrative brings us closer, as close to the lived reality of early Mormons as we are ever likely to reach. Her style is matter-of-fact, neither sentimental nor sensational. She reads the documents closely, recounting her subject's daily tasks, religious observances, and women's meetings, as in this remarkable example from Patty Sessions. Almost 2 months after arriving in the Salt Lake Valley, Patty Sessions and her family moved into a two-room house in the fort, a log and adobe structure with windowless back walls forming a stockade. She delivered 6 babies that month, a perfectly manageable number except that the births sometimes came in clusters, forcing her to rush from one woman to another and get little sleep. She still found time to stitch a coat for one of the battalion vets, quilled a petticoat for her granddaughter, Martha Ann, put up curtains in her rude home, and wash and anoint Heber Kimball's pregnant wife, Ellen Sanders, as he had asked her to do when she met him on the trail. The washing and anointing was a healing ritual with no apparent scriptural foundation, although it surely derived from ceremonies performed in the Nauvoo Temple. When Heber asked her to anoint Ellen, he was affirming Patty's spiritual power rather than her expertise as a midwife. At this point, no one questioned the right of women to heal by the power of faith. This remarkable paragraph tells us almost everything we want to know, everything I want to know. But then Laurel goes on to reveal the frequency and ease of women's meetings. She tells us in November, I have been to meetings 5 times this week, females' meetings. And she figures that Sessions and Eliza R. Snow, packed into the crowded dwelling around the fort where they all lived, participated in such gatherings almost every other day through October and November, and then almost daily in December. Women who had known each other in winter quarters or on the trail were in constant contact. The men, by contrast, were often away on exploring or surveying expeditions, or in the canyons cutting timber, or on missions, or marching with the Mormon battalion. Ulrich shows how women were often without their men, and notes that missionaries went to far places for as long as 7 years, usually without their families. Some would learn of the deaths of wives and children months later. The female relationships could easily be stronger than the marital ones, one of the real stories of the early church. In Utah, the Relief Societies evolved into more structured institutions. Skillful women emerged to lead the groups, and they became strong and powerful. And for a decade, life proceeded in an orderly fashion in Utah, with its industrious citizens and its blooming desert. But in 1857, the U.S. government set out to subdue the territory. Even as federal troops approached the Salt Lake Valley, the ladies of the 14th Ward Relief Society created an album quilt that won first prize at the territorial fair. Ulrich, who takes the material culture of women seriously, interprets this quilt, its designs, its creators, and the social scene in detail, and gives us this observation. When we look at the quilt today, it is hard to imagine it emerging from such turmoil, but it did. The quilt takes us beneath headlines to the symbolic language through which Phoebe Woodruff and her sisters defended their faith, their civility, and their patriotism. This was not the language of indignation, but of quiet dignity. Interpreted alongside their own fragmentary writings, the quilt exposes the complexity of their decision to behave as ladies when assaulted from without by threats of invasion and from within by their own complex feelings about plural marriage. Ulrich dramatizes the coexistence of important and conflicting historical themes. Women, during the invasion of foreign troops, were quilting. Amazing. Mormonism was and is an unlikely survivor. As disillusioned early adherents left the church during persecutions, the church missionaries replenished the core group. the Mormons made a final stand on a barren, thinly populated frontier. This story has been told many ways. Laurel Ulrich has skillfully mined the diaries of both women and men to tell her tale with women fully present. My only disappointment with this wonderful book is that there was no long, detailed, powerful diary of a woman to anchor the study. I hope that women are now writing the thoughtful diaries that the next generation will use for a basis for such studies. Thank you.
Hi. So somehow the title of these sorts of sessions make me feel like I have to say something critical, and I do a bit, but not very much, just a bit. I also should mention that I did review this book for the Weston Historical Quarterly in summer 2018, but I only had 900 words, so I didn't say very much. So I'm delighted for this opportunity to nuance my more interesting thoughts from that review. I'm going to focus on elements of the conversation about this book that are perhaps a bit unique to my areas of specialty. And I also want to say that I'm not very good at, like, quoting and unquoting, so I'm going to air quote. So if you want to know what she says as opposed to what I say, you have to watch me. In her 2002 autobiographical essay, A Pail of Cream, Ulrich says that her writing life has moved in two directions, one activist and personal, the other academic. Her personal essays helped her work out the contradictions in my life as a wife, mother, teacher, scholar, active churchgoer, and emerging feminist. A House Full of Females brings together, I think, Ulrich's scholarly interest in American history and personal interest in LDS women and LDS feminism. What I want to do today is not so much critique, but to open up a conversation about the cultural and perhaps activist work Ulrich's book does on behalf of LDS women. Eschewing presentism, which I'm not going to eschew, but Ulrich does not address LDS feminism's search for a usable past. Perhaps unwittingly, I don't know, she nonetheless participates in the project of locating such a past for LDS women seeking agency and authority. In this book, she argues that LDS women possessed an authority both real and limited, emphasizing the real while at times understating, though always acknowledging, the limited. Of course, it's important that 19th century LDS women had any real agency or authority at all in an unapologetically patriarchal church with a marriage system it called patriarchal marriage, and Ulrich's work demonstrates that. As she claims, this was patriarchy with a soft voice, male dominance with a caress. But it's also important, especially in contemporary context of debates over women's authority in the church, to lay bare the avenues within which and the limitations under which LDS foremothers operated. Ulrich's book does this as well, though she perhaps gives the women in her narrative more power than I would. One element of early LDS women's empowerment had to do with what Ulrich calls a kind of role reversal, while LDS men served missions and did some of the kinds of other things that Claudia talked about. Men called to preach no longer had the ability or even the obligation to provide for families, Ulrich says. And in this context, women had to step up, and in the stepping, empowered themselves as leaders of families, though it may be important to acknowledge, not often as heads of households. Yet, as Ulrich acknowledges, this empowerment sometimes came at a cost. For example, when Wilfred and Phoebe Woodruff's daughter died while Wilfred was away preaching, Phoebe had no one to comfort her sorrow. Men's missionary work also came at a cost, to be sure, but that cost seems to me much more voluntarily paid. Their work cost the support and presence of their loved ones in times of need when they elected to leave, not when they were left by virtue of someone else's choice. Another way Ulrich's narrative reveals women's agency and authority is in her discussion of the implications of early LDS marriage systems for women. Polygamy, more than other marriage and family structures of the time, depended on women's consent, at least in theory, and if women's public statements count as consent more than their private heartbreaks and uncertainties. One way Ulrich unpacks the power of women's consent is to discuss the implications of relatively easy divorce practices for the lives and families of the LDS women who sought them. When Mary Ann Woodruff sought a divorce from Wilford Woodruff, for example, she was granted it, and Wilford was required to continue supporting the children. Intimate histories like this reveal that divorce was perhaps the safety valve that made polygamy work, and women used it. Perhaps for this reason, Ulrich asserts that Smith's claim that men had the worst of it in plural marriage had some foundation. Men with leadership aspirations were pressured into the practice. Polygamy was clearly expected of men of stature and status in early LDS communities. What Ulrich nuances better than Bathsheba, though, is that women, too, were likely also pressured into polygamy, though usually without accompanying opportunities for formal leadership. Of course, women most often consented to plural marriage, but especially in the idyllic community early Latter-day Saints were trying to create, women's consent coexisted alongside social, financial, personal, spiritual, and other pressures that engineered their agreement. Their private writings reveal the discontent marbled in with their consent, and at least in some instances, the pointlessness of resistance. I'll get to that in a second. In the conversation Bathsheba Smith documented, she continued that she and some friends, quote, partly concluded to say to our husbands to take all the wives they pleased, as we know that they would anyhow, perhaps. Here, though, Ulrich points to the potential for disagreement embedded in the words partly and perhaps, rather than to another potential conclusion, that resistance to polygamy may, for some women, have been partly or perhaps futile. While early LDS polygamy empowered women to choose marriage and divorce, it also constrained those choices by imposing emotional and theological consequences if they chose incorrectly. Ulrich seems hesitant to concede, for example, the inherent intimate patriarchy of Joseph Smith's revelation encouraging Emma into conformity with plural marriage. In another less well-known instance that both folks have talked about, William Clayton, quote, made, and that's Ulrich's term, not mine, his wife Margaret promise not to marry another man, Aaron Farr, and dictated a letter for Margaret to send Aaron declaring her intentions not to marry him. Clearly, the patriarchy embedded in this exchange constrained Margaret's choices. Later, when Farr had returned from his mission, Clayton asked Margaret if he wanted a divorce, and her answer was cryptic. Clayton, quote, wanted her, but he wanted her willingly, and so prayed that she would learn to love those who she ought, i.e. him. Thus, when he could not control Margaret's affections, Clayton invited God to. This vignette exhibits Clayton's soft voice and caress, to be sure, but is also partly and perhaps a demonstration of the futility of Margaret's resistance to Clayton's demands. So while early LDS marriage practices empowered women to make a broader array of choices about marriage, polygamy was surely not free of coercion, probably for men and women, and it did not always provide women the resources to enact the choices they might otherwise make. That is, women could choose, but they made those choices within structures and contexts that formulated and limited their options. One of those structures was the carefully delineated theological and social place of motherhood in early LDS culture. At one point, Ulrich says that, quote, Latter-day Saint theology liberated male sexuality by transforming lust into responsibility and by giving every woman an opportunity to marry and become a mother. I read this statement with great ambivalence for two reasons. First, the theological function of motherhood here, and perhaps the social function, was to liberate men's sexuality. Thus, giving every woman an opportunity to marry and become a mother seems much more a gift to men than women. Liberating men's sexuality while constraining women's roles. Second, and I want to be clear about this, motherhood is great. And the sentence also assumes that motherhood is uniformly a gift. And as an experience, much of it probably is. But as I read this claim, I was also reminded of Adrian Rich's analysis of motherhood as an institution, which is very different from motherhood as an experience, that Rich claims that patriarchy uses to control women. She argues that motherhood pays women off for their subjugation, perhaps with soft voices and caresses, with a sense of value and mission, and with cultural veneration and reverence for the role. And I'm happy to get more into Adrienne Rich if people are interested in the Q&A. But suffice it to say here that this seems a useful way to consider the function of motherhood among early and perhaps modern Latter-day Saints. Even with a soft voice and caress, patriarchy also demanded quiet, subversive resistance. In a quietly subversive use of the theological role of motherhood, Eliza R. Snow mobilized motherhood to affirm a female divine, a mother in heaven. Snow affirms the power and perhaps also the invisibility of motherhood at the same time, and at the same time offers the explosive notion of a joint male-female deity, Ulrich says. Yet the explosive potential of Snow's theological move has been and continues to be contained by the LDS emphasis on motherhood as a private experience and the invisibility of motherhood as an institution or a public performance. A subversion compelled to be too quiet is not a subversion at all. Ulrich's discussion of LDS women's public lives also demonstrates, perhaps inadvertently, their subordination and at times the limits of their ability to act officially without male endorsement or at least approval. True, women healed, washed, and anointed and presided, but they did so almost always, not always, but almost always, either among and over only women or in the midst of crisis where men were not available. This sort of problem with Ulrich's protagonist to exercise authority outside male endorsement tacitly tells us something about early LDS women. Many, if not most, instances of LDS women's public ecclesiastical authority revolved around men's and occurred not just in relationship to men, but perhaps because of men. Most often, women's ability to act for themselves was allocated to them by men, men's to give, not women's to claim. This is especially evident in her discussion of perhaps the most referenced moment among historians of LDS women, the founding of the Relief Society. And I'm not going to get into the meaning of the key bit here, because that's a Pandora's box I'm not interested in opening. But what does interest me is Ulrich's framing of what happens after the selection of the Relief Society president and officers. Ulrich is quick to suggest that the sisters themselves selected the founding officers, but makes little of the fact that Joseph Smith gave them that responsibility, minimizing again the fact that it was his to give, not theirs to claim. Ulrich's account of this event also leads to perhaps my least favorite clause in the book. Even when men were present, the sisters could think for themselves. And I have to admit, I couldn't quite tell if you meant this tongue-in-cheek or not. So if you did, please ignore what I'm about to say. Just completely ignore it. So I've struggled quite a bit with why I found this sentence so a bit disappointing and come to the conclusion that it's because Ulrich treats thinking itself as the meaningful accomplishment documented in the Relief Society minutes. And in a sense it is, but to celebrate it as such misses significant pieces of the effects of patriarchy. Many women throughout the history of thinking have thought for themselves, though we're perhaps unable to document it. One profound effect of patriarchy is the inability of women to mobilize those thoughts in the world. To be sure, Mormon women could enact their ideas in the institutionalized church, but most often when enabled and approved by the power of the male priesthood. As Ulrich argues, marital relationships under church patriarchy may have been softly voiced and touched, but the degree to which women can mobilize thoughts in the world may be the measure of the booming of its voice and austerity of its touch. My purpose here has not been necessarily to measure the precise degree of early LDS women's empowerment. Women's empowerment was and is not always on a continuum with patriarchy as its opposite. Rather, for early LDS women, empowerment ran alongside patriarchy, and the two have to be measured with separate instruments. Rather, I've wanted to explore via Ulrich's work the complexity and difficulty of recovering a usable past for Mormon feminism. Here, Ulrich gives readers a great gift, examples and analyses of how individual women navigated their real but limited authority in and outside the church, in and outside relationships to men. Ulrich illustrates a wide array of options women chose as they navigated not only the tangled dictum of 19th century womanhood that women achieved moral authority by asking nothing for themselves, but the often contradictory demands, repressions, and allowances of their faith. For contemporary women living conflicted, contradictory, and convoluted lives, a conflicted, contradictory, and convoluted past is perhaps the most usable one. Thank you.
Thank you. I can't imagine having any better, kinder, more engaged, and more insightful commentators. I mean, they were too kind, probably all three of them, but I really appreciate that, of course, because I have to stand up now and say some things for myself. And I really am going to try to be concise, if I can, and focused, if I can, on what I have to say. So I think I will, to help me kind of go from Gary to Claudia to Chris. By way of preface, however, I want to elaborate how much I admire and respect and have learned from these three commentators. I think it would be hard to exaggerate the importance of the work of Signature Press and Smith Pettit in my own work, as well as in the Mormon History Association, or the amazingly skilled service at many, many levels of Gary Brugera. And of course, you've all heard that Claudia and I have a very long relationship, but she actually is responsible for getting me into history. As many of you know, I was an English major at the University of Utah, and I finished a graduate degree, master's degree in English in Boston after we moved there. And I, as some of us began to respond in the late 60s to the growing voices of the new feminism, one day I had a telephone conversation with Claudia, and she told me two things. That there may have been two telephone conversations, but anyway, I've conflated them. Two things. One, I really think we need to take a look at some of this literature. That was the first thing. The second thing was she announced that she had gone back to graduate school. She was at Boston University. And I said to her, "What are you going to study?" And she said something no one has ever thought of yet, women's history. And I've thought about that over the years, over and over and over again, as Claudia and her cohort at Boston University and others were so kind to me and embraced me when I sort of meandered over to the history department at the University of New Hampshire and began my transformation into a new field as well. And then finally, Chris, who represents the most, well, she represents the movement into the future for women's history, for gender studies, for queer theory, the wonderful way in which scholars over the last 30 years or so have complicated and enriched and strengthened that work. And I just live with Chris and others over my shoulders reminding me, you know, we've got new things to teach you old ladies. And so I'm so appreciative of the gracious way in which she does that. Okay, I'm just going to pick up on some key thoughts from each of those who commented. The first, Gary's wonderful, subtle outing my methods. And I kept thinking of the Emily Dickinson poem, the line, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant." And that has long been my method. But I have to confess to Gary, and also it's wonderful to hear Gary admit the same thing, that the more I learned about Nauvoo and the introduction of celestial marriage, the less I feel that I know. Some of the most important things I learned, I learned from Gary's, from his many articles, which dig into things that I might not have seen or understood, but particularly from his wonderful accounting and systematic computing of plural marriages, all plural marriages, not just to Joseph Smith, in before Joseph Smith's death. And I just have a dog-eared copy of that article that I went back again and again and again to. I tried to complicate it. I tried to enlarge the meaning of what he was telling us, but it was a foundation for what I was working with. Now, I probably, when you couldn't decide whether I agreed or disagreed with the secondary source, it's because I couldn't decide whether I agreed or disagreed. And in fact, there were moments when I thought, could I just skip Nauvoo? But I had committed myself to Wilford Woodruff's diary. And obviously, Nauvoo was right there. I had to deal with Nauvoo. And the original purpose of my book was not to write a book with the title Polygamy and Women's Rights, and my publisher had a lot to do with that. Although it was an original question for me, because the proto-feminism of the exponent and the women's suffrage movement in early Utah had been so empowering to me. It was a usable past for my generation. It's now being greatly complicated, but it was a usable past for my generation. So I really did want to go back with my now practiced historical skills and reassess that. But my original goal was to try to write a book using Mormon diaries. And the original diary that I fell in love with, which was a signature contribution, was Wilford Woodruff's diary, which blew me away. And I looked for a comparable female diary. As Claudia says, it doesn't exist. And so I came up with the idea of multiple voices using Wilfred's diary as a kind of spine. So he disappears almost. He's in every chapter, his diary. He disappears. He comes back. It's not a book about him, but it's a book about diaries and male diaries as well as female diaries. And so the point that Gary made that I embrace, although I would love to hear more from him about cognitive dissonance theory and his ideas about what on earth is going on and why those, I mean, it makes sense to me. Joseph Smith doubles down on a practice that almost blew things apart. But there's a psychological answer, perhaps, or a religious answer, as some would say. I'd like to know more about it. I'd like to hear more from anyone who wants to write about that, but the best I could come up with was it happened. And the best I could do in this book was to say, look, this is the skeleton of what we know from period sources. And if we could just start there with the uncertainty, the confusion, the contradictions, then the whole story that comes later makes more sense. At least it does to me. So that takes me to Claudia's fascinating contrast between Smith and his wives and Brigham Young and his wives. Couldn't be starker. Brigham Young created plural marriage in Mormonism out of what he inherited from Joseph Smith. If Joseph Smith laid out a platform, he didn't share it. And so much was secret. So we have to rely on Brigham that this is what Joseph wanted us to do and others. The old idea that polygamy was Brigham Young's idea doesn't make sense to me. But that Brigham created the system and others who had become deeply implicated in the practice by the time of Joseph Smith's death seems real, and maybe again, cognitive dissonance theory comes in there to explain part of that, or God. As a commentator said in a talk I gave a number of years ago, you need to kind of think this through. Did God tell Joseph Smith to introduce polygamy? Or did Joseph Smith believe God told him to introduce polygamy? Or did God let Joseph Smith introduce polygamy? And the way you would answer those questions says how you think revelation works in the world and what happens with individual responses to those things. Okay, I really appreciate Claudia's highlighting of the contrasting and important sources of the Nauvoo minutes and the indignation meeting minutes, which are the kind of the bookends to the book. And to see the indignation meeting as a kind of reaffirmation of the spiritual and organizational power of women in the church. Now, the context is complicated and there are many contradictions, but those two really are primary source points that we need to think about. And what's new for me, not new for the many scholars who laid out this foundational work before me, Carol Madsen, Jill Durr, Maureen Ersenbach, Linda Newell, the many wonderful scholars who've worked on this, was that validation of women's organizational, maybe not their spiritual, but their organizational and institutional power was taken away abruptly and dramatically by Brigham Young. And it was not easy to get it back. That was a really important insight for me as I worked through the diary and as I watched women working in a system that had validated them and then invalidated them in important ways. And that takes me to Chris. I agree with everything you've said, Chris, because what you're doing is reading the raw material that I have put together in the way best way I can. You're opening it up now for a serious critique is this any kind of, is there anything usable in this story? Is there anything we can take from this heroic and tragic and messy story? What can we take from this into our own lives? You were very astute, I think, to pick up that quotation from early in the book about a patriarchy with a soft and gentle voice. And that quotation came, I think, from Parley Pratt in the Millennial Star when they were trying to decide how much authority the women could have in the early English congregations during those British missions. And he was quoting Paul, but then he was trying to be very generous about all the things they could do, especially they could supply the material needs of the missionaries. But he did acknowledge their spiritual power, and he was being very gentle and very encouraging. It's a voice we all recognize that's been there all through LDS history. But that was not my statement about how patriarchy operated in the long period that I talked about in the diary. That was about how it operated for Parley Pratt. And I think the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants is a terrifying voice of patriarchy in its very last section. Terrifying. And I think we need to confront that. That is not patriarchy with a soft voice. That is patriarchy or you be damned. And we don't often say that, and I think I said it, and I think I showed it in the book, although not saying, this is the way I feel about it. But there were a lot of other things in that 132nd section that then people used in different ways to create different kinds of empowerment. So I loved Chris's final statement. Maybe the best, the most usable path for a messy world is a messy story. And I am the first to admit this is a very messy story. In the end, however, it was empowering for me to watch women under some of the worst of circumstances complain, squabble, be angry, submit when you didn't want them to submit, but somehow manage to thrive and pass on some remarkable things that I cherish and think are worth preserving. Thank you.